Momentum is building for renewed global efforts to tackle climate change as world leaders in New York prepare to attend another day of meetings of the UN Security Council. Already, the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, is calling on humanity to grow up and avert a catastrophic increase in temperatures. This comes after the Chinese President, Xi Jinping, announced that China would no longer fund coal-fired power plants abroad. Erin Sikorski is the director of the Center for Climate and Security, a think tank based in Washington, D.C., and director of the International Military Council on Climate and Security. Erin, welcome to Breakfast.
Thanks so much for having me.
So yesterday at the UN General Assembly, we saw one of the world's top emitters, China, pledging it would no longer fund coal-fired power plants abroad. The Chinese government, though, is still investing in coal. So how significant is this in terms of any real shift away from fossil fuels by China?
It's a good first step, right? It's a good step on the international stage to move away from coal in other countries and sends a signal that we really need to move in a better direction. But there's, of course, more to do. As you mentioned, China still is the top producer of coal internally within their country, and so that needs to come next.
Well, Australia is a major coal exporter. Would some analysts here have predicted that this move by China won't actually mean much for Australia because most of China's investment is in countries who are not the major importers of Australian coal? Is that your assessment?
Yes, I think that there's more that Australia will have to do separate from this to tackle these issues and move forward. It really needs to be all hands on deck, right? It can't just be one country, but all countries need to lead on this.
But when we here have the debate about all hands on deck, inevitably the question comes back to what about China? Last year, Xi Jinping pledged that China will reach carbon neutrality by 2060. He's signalling now that it will be before 2060, but with no date offered. How much will it take for China to achieve that? Do you believe they're on track, and have you got any sense of, you know, whether they want to beat that target?
So, you know, the UN released its latest report on the risks from climate change in August, and the report was unequivocal. We're facing many threats around the globe. We saw it this summer: fires, floods, drought, you know, in every corner, rich or poor. And so, you know, countries recognize that there are risks to themselves. China faces risks within its own borders. It's got millions of people living in coastal cities that are threatened by sea level rise. It has risks of drought and food security crises in its central part of the country. So from my sense, looking in from the outside, is there are conversations, strategic conversations happening within the country, recognizing the risks to their own population if we continue on the trajectory we're on, and appetite for change. But of course, there's internal politics, just as there are in many countries, as they move to make these decisions going forward.
So what have you seen that you find encouraging? And is it encouraging enough at the UN this week? The Secretary General says he's encouraged by the US and Chinese announcement. The US itself pledged to double the amount for the global fund for aiding developing nations to adjust to renewable energy and to move out of fossil fuels. So Antonio Guterres says he's encouraged by these, but warned the world was on a catastrophic path to 2.7 degrees Celsius heating above pre-industrial levels. So are we seeing pledges ambitious enough from the global superpowers, US and China?
I think there are steps in the right direction, but more needs to be done, and more needs to be done quickly. I also think it's absolutely critical that we cut emissions to avoid catastrophe in the second half of the century. But what we learned again this summer is that certain changes are already baked in to the system. And over the next 10 to 20 years, even if all emissions were cut tomorrow, there are extreme weather hazards, climate shocks coming that we need to be prepared for. And so making sure that, you know, countries can walk and chew gum at the same time, right? Make plans to cut emissions, but then also fund adaptation and resilience, because the security risks of where we're going are just overwhelming for many countries, as you've seen, again, in the Middle East this summer, in the Indo-Pacific. I mean, countries can't withstand these shocks. And so we need to invest in resilience and adaptation as well. And countries need to lead at the UN on that.
Let's go to the security risks more intently. Your background is in intelligence. Is climate change an area that intelligence communities in the US and other countries like Australia are putting front and centre of their risk assessment processes? Is it getting enough focus? Is it getting any focus?
It is getting focus. I think in the United States, when you look at the risk testimony that the Director of National Intelligence provides to Congress every year, climate change is discussed. The Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, has spoken publicly about the need to focus more on climate change and make it central, because it really is shaping the entire national security landscape, from direct threats to militaries, to their infrastructure, to their readiness, to stressing governments that already are facing strains due to COVID, all around the world. So intelligence communities are recognizing this. The challenge is you need to have personnel with the scientific literacy to be able to integrate climate modeling, climate risk assessments into your day-to-day work. You don't need a bunch of climate scientists in the intel community, but what you do need are people who have national security backgrounds but can also then look at that climate science and bring it in. And I think that's where more and more intelligence communities around the world are realizing they need to invest resources and personnel.
And Erin, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the situation in Australia, but are you aware whether our intelligence and our defence communities are prioritising this enough and as much as some of our major allies? It's important for Australia, obviously, with the strategic focus on the Indo-Pacific.
Right. There's a great group that was just launched in the past year of Australian security leaders for climate change. And these are former military and security leaders in Australia who have come together to put this issue on the front burner. They're a member of the International Military Council on Climate and Security. And so they're doing, from their perspective, they can speak to when they were serving in the military, how they saw climate risks play out and why it's so important. And so I know they're pushing for it to be considered more and more in the defense and security services there.
Erin Sikorski, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Erin Sikorski from the Center for Climate and Security in Washington, D.C.